You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's a sad but all too common fact of New York life. One morning you wake up to find that the mom-and-pop grocery store down the block has been replaced by a bank, that the neighborhood coffee joint is now a Starbucks, and that the building your dentist's office is in is being turned into condos. Photographers James and Carla Murray have spent the past 10 years documenting the changes in our city, and now they have published a book called Storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York. It's from Ginkgo Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings James and Carla Murray to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
This book is an update of an earlier, larger coffee table book that you published in 2009. Were there that many changes that you had to update it just after a couple of years?
It wasn't so much the changes. It was more the size. The publisher said, let's make a portable, smaller version of it, because so many people said, oh, they can't carry the book around with them, to try to locate the different stores to see if they were still in business or not in business. So that was kind of an executive decision on their part to still have the big coffee table size one, which is like 7 pounds and really not portable at all.
And this one even has a binder, or one of the versions, the new version.
Yeah, that's a little calendar, a postcard calendar that also came out. And then the little postcards are perforated and they rip off. You can send them to people. And
so is the two books exactly the same, the big coffee table book and this version?
They have the same exact content.
Like, because New York keeps on changing.
Right. We're actually working on a follow-up book to this original storefront to include other neighborhoods, especially in Brooklyn and the outer boroughs, that we didn't have a chance to include in the original.
James, how many of the storefronts profiled in the original or in this book are still in business today? Do we know?
Over half of the book's content are closed or gone.
Really?
Yeah.
One of the amusing things, or not so amusing things, is that just 20 years ago, all of the kinds of stores we're talking about were being closed and being replaced by Benetton's and David's Cookies, and now they're all gone.
Yep.
Which is, some people say that's the glory of New York, but it's also a sad, well, I'm not so sorry to see the Benetton's go, but I was sorry to see the shoe repair stores and some of the local appetizing stores, the delis. Did you pick the ones that you photographed simply because they had the best signs?
I would definitely say that it was for the look and feel, like the aesthetic of them. For us, it had to look a certain way, and I don't know, I guess it was just kind of a feeling, right, that we had when starting the project.
Initially, the project was driven purely by aesthetics, but once we took the next step and went in and started sitting down and spending the day with some of the owners, then it became more about the history and the background of each store, which is fascinating. I mean, the amount of pride involved in these businesses, the struggles they face, it just really got us hooked.
When you mentioned aesthetics, one of the aesthetics of this book is that every photograph is perfectly straight on. That was a decision you made from the start?
Actually not.
Did it require special equipment?
Not really. I mean, All the photographs are 35 millimeter, and we started the project so long ago, like in the mid-90s, that really digital photography wasn't in existence. I mean, in its infancy. I mean, certainly, you know, I guess the first digital camera was, you know, something like equivalent to your cell phone camera, and it was so expensive we didn't even own one. So we started with film, and it was, you know, really the signage that got us interested in the first place.
Well, weren't you originally thinking about doing something about graffiti artists?
Yeah, originally we were shooting graffiti art. We did a book called Broken Windows, and then its follow-up called Burning New York. And graffiti is a letter-based art form. There's a lot of flow and movement to the letters. And while we were shooting the graffiti walls, we noticed all these mom-and-pop stores with the beautiful neons and the script and the different typographies, and we started to document those once we realized they were disappearing.
Exactly, because we would often go back to the same like neighborhood location to re-photograph like a graffiti wall that got repainted, and then we were like, wait a minute, what happened to that great store that was across the street from it? It's gone now, and that you know, that was awful to us because we really liked it for whatever, you know, which way, the sign, or we got something there and we're like, oh, that was a great little store. And they were disappearing.
So when did you decide to go to digital, or have you just been consistent with film?
We didn't get our first digital camera until 2006. And we were definitely late in the game. I mean, we still use our 35 millimeter a lot. I mean, we feel like a dinosaur going in and getting our film developed, to be perfectly honest. But we love the grain.
We made a conscious decision to keep this book film because we like that kind of grain and patina to the photos that just kind of established a feel.
But also there seems to be a philosophical similarity because we're talking analog with something that may feel a little old-fashioned, but at the same time, like vinyl discs, some people prefer.
Exactly. Yeah, film offers, we feel, a lot more, just as a vinyl offers way more than an MP3. So we definitely see the parallel.
Right, and also kind of that we are documenting old stores, so it felt kind of more right to stick with film, even though, you know, technology, you know, has changed.
In addition to individual images of storefronts, you also include some panoramas of entire blocks. Why did you decide these images were necessary, like Grand Street between Essex and Norfolk Street?
That we absolutely loved. We loved that, you know, just growing up in New York and remembering walking by, it was like mom and pop, one after the other after the other. There was no chain stores, really. So the panoramas, because we had developed that technique of photographing these long, long strips from photographing long graffiti walls, we're like, oh, this would be great to include the particular avenues or streets where there was continuous mom-and-pop stores. So if there was anything a Starbucks, I guess you could say, in the frame in that particular block, we wouldn't photograph the whole block. We would just do the individual stores. But if it looked great and there was all the mom-and-pops one next to one another, we'd get the whole entire avenue or block.
Did you find some blocks that you documented that have undergone almost complete change?
Definitely. I mean, in the book, if you look at, in particular, there's only one left on the Graham Avenue in Brooklyn, and that's in Williamsburg. There's only one of the stores left that was in that long panorama, and that runs from Siegel to, I forget what the other street is, but right. It's the, you know, along Graham Avenue from one end to the other.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What do you think determines whether the old stores remain or not? Do you think it's because some neighborhoods remain more, still retain their old ethnic qualities, so people are more likely to want to have that specialty store?
I think more that it's, what we found was that was the death of the mom and pop, was they didn't own the building. That was pretty much it. I mean, you know, pretty recently, like starting, I guess, in the 2000s. They started disappearing rapidly because of first the economic boom and then the price of real estate went crazy and then the recession.
And then restaurants start raising the rents extraordinarily. Not restaurants, landlords raise the rent
exactly.
Extraordinarily. And the next thing you know, that favorite store is gone because
exactly.
They just couldn't keep up with the new cost.
Right. It was just their profit margin isn't that great, so they can't afford the rent when, you know, it's tripled or quadrupled or even, you know, tenfold sometimes.
My guests are James and Carla Murray. Their book, Storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York, which is published by Ginkgo Press. You talked to the store owners, and is that what they said, that it was just skyrocketing rents that drove them out?
Definitely. I mean, that's why we chose the image for the back cover of the book, Katie's Candy. It was a great, great penny candy store. I mean, we went in there in 2004, and the owner was literally selling candy for a penny still, and she had, like, CNC colas for 25 cents. She tried to keep the prices low because she said she wanted to keep the kids out of drugs in the neighborhood. She had lived there all her life in Bed-Stuy. And she was a really, really sweet woman. And they wanted to make her building into luxury condos. This was, you know, during the boom. And like I said, in 2004, when we went in there, she already knew that he wanted her out. And then I guess by the end of 2007, he had forced her out, even though she still had a lease. And unfortunately, after that, it stayed empty because then the economy went south and the condo project never got off the ground, and the storefront's still empty today. So it was really sad and tragic.
James, a couple of the stores that are in this book, DePaulo's and Russ and Daughters, we've discussed with the owners and their whole concern about moving it from one generation to another. Isn't that another reason some of these stores close? The kids don't want to take it over, and there's nobody else who really wants it.
Owner after owner said that exact point, that they've done so well that a lot of their kids now are doctors, lawyers, and they wanted a better life for their kids. Where we talked to a guy who makes cannolis at 4 a.m. He's like, I didn't want my kids to have to get up 7 days a week, work the 70 hours a week. So it kind of put a nail in it that way, that they did so well. That their kids now are just so far removed from the business.
Right. They gave their kids a really great education because, you know, a lot of them didn't have an opportunity to have an education themselves and went into the business to help support their family, you know, as immigrants or whatever the story was. And they, yes, Jim said, they worked really, really hard to make a better life for their children. They honestly didn't want the children to carry on the business.
And a better life for themselves, like, owner after owner would say to us, you know, I don't have to do this anymore. It's just I love doing it. Like, I love getting up making cannolis, core pastry. This is all I know. You know, this is I love doing it. And some of the owners actually make money now renting. They own the whole building. That's how they stayed in business. And they rent the top floors out, and that's where their primary income comes from now, and they just do
from renting apartments.
Exactly, and they still do their trade, their profession, just for love, pure.
Now we have a slideshow on our show page at wnyc.org of some of the images from this book, but we also asked our listeners to write, to tweet us, or to go on Facebook and talk about their favorite storefronts. Rebecca Warner Pearsall posted a picture of Murder Incorporated, Murder Inc., I-N-K, and also Ivy's books on our Facebook page. It was her husband's store.
Oh, that's great.
But a lot of people, I'm sure, remember the good old days when they had the store, and for one reason or another, in the case of bookstores, they're going out of business for reasons that have nothing to do with what we're just discussing. Although the mom and pops are making some kind of a return, it's the stores that put the old mom and pops out of business that are having problems, like Barnes & Noble.
Exactly. You know, I guess because of e-books and, you know, that sort of thing, bookstores, I guess, are kind of a separate niche versus other retail. You know, for us, it seemed to us that it was the food-related businesses that seemed to suffer the most as far as the closures.
Food-related because of what? Because of changing tastes?
It could have been like Zito's, for instance, on in Greenwich Village.
The Bleecker Street.
Exactly.
Bakery.
On Bleecker Street. We photographed that in 2001, and they closed pretty soon afterwards. And it was because of, at the time, there was this whole thing where you shouldn't be eating bread. You know, like carbohydrates are bad for you. And that was kind of the diet that was being pushed. That, you know, no more bagels, no more breads, and then their business suffered, so they decided to close.
And now, Jim, there are too many bagel stores, I think.
Exactly.
Making big, puffy bagels.
Exactly. And the pork sausage stores that used to hang the meat in the windows, they're not allowed to do that anymore.
Ah.
But
Chinese stores can still hang ducks and chickens in the windows.
I couldn't tell you the exact reason, but we know for sure because there was one, Kirowiki's and Sons, was in our own neighborhood of the East Village. They were told they had to remove all their cured meats from their window. They had them hanging in hooks in their window and
because
behind the counter.
Because the sun was hitting them?
The city came and said, oh, because of like salmonella or whatever it was, you know, you have to remove it for health reasons, and you now have to keep everything in a refrigerated locker. And that's what he did. He had to put it all downstairs in his meat locker. And then he's like, oh, this is killing my business because it was all based on like sight and smell. Like you'd come into the store and you'd smell these meats hanging.
People walk in and they're like, oh, are you going out of business? Because they couldn't smell that aroma. He's like, my whole business is built on the senses, smell, taste. So that all the struggles we learned, so many pressures come from so many different angles that it's really incredible what they face day to day.
And the parking tickets.
They explain that a lot of their business, especially like Little Italy, all the parking lots that were down there at one time have all been made into condos. They've built construction on there. So a lot of, as Little Italy changed, as families began to move out to the outer boroughs, to Staten Island, people would drive back in on the weekend to get their specialty. And they explain now that if they come down, there's nowhere to park, they'll double park their car, run in to get their cheese, and they come out and they have a $160 mm-hmm. ticket. And he's like, once they get 101 ticket, they're probably never going to come back again.
It's a lot to pay for a nice hunk of Parmesan, no matter how good it is.
Exactly.
And we had dozens of owners that just explained that same thing.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with husband and wife photographers, James and Carla Murray. Their book, Storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York, is published by Ginkgo Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with James T. and Carla L. Murray, a husband and wife photography team whose latest book is called Storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York, published by Ginkgo Press. Is it? I don't know of too many other husband and wife teams. There are other photographers who are married, but they tend not to work together. How did this happen for you?
Well, we met and we were friends for a long time before we married one another. And, you know, we always had our passion for photography. We were doing other things at the time. But once we got together, we realized that it was important to, you know, just follow your heart. And photography was really where our heart was. And we worked so well together. Everyone says that we have four eyes. And that's why, like, our photography is...
It really complements each other.
Right, so polished, I guess. I mean, we can finish each other's sentences.
Well, do you split the responsibilities, James? Do you take half the pictures and call her the other half?
No, it's really just who happens to have the camera that day.
Right, the interviews are all me. Mm-hmm. That I'll, you know, say with 100%, because we found early on in the project that most of the store owners, they opened up more to a woman than speaking with a man. So I took control of that aspect of the project. But the photography was pretty much 50-50 as far as taking the actual photos. And then the composites, because the panoramas are even though they're all 35 millimeter, we had to scan them and composite them in a computer to get, you know, put them all together. That's all Jim.
Yeah,
the
block-long panoramas of all the stores in a block, those are composites of, say, 40, 50 frames of 35 millimeter.
Wow. So you just walk down the street and click, 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 and
sure.
Put them together on the computer?
Sometimes it was like 3 or 4 hours. I remember when we shot Bleecker Street, where the Zito's was, and Murray's Cheese happened to be right next door at the time. They moved across the street to a bigger location now, but I was there for... Yeah, a good 3 or 4 hours, because it's continuously cars. If you notice, there's no cars in any of the mm-hmm. photos. So we have to wait, you know, or delivery truck or anything. So it can take quite a while.
And as the project went on, we got more and more carried away with it. We would wear the traffic vests, and I would block off a lane of traffic for her so she could stand out in the lane. And we got more and more carried away. But those would take about 10, 12 hours a day for 3 weeks trying to put those together, because we would shoot the top, middle, and bottom of each store, composite that together, and then go on to the next store and put those together.
Well, you do have people in some of these pictures. Didn't some of the store owners tell you about the various rules and regulations that govern signage in New York City?
Are they
the same as they have always been? I mean, can they keep signs that were put up in 1929, or do they have to change it?
No, The New York City apparently has changed its law over the years, and they don't allow large overhanging signs anymore. I mean, some may be grandfathered in that they're okay, but I forget what it is, but I think it's 10 or 12 inches. It can't overhang onto the sidewalk very much anymore. And one of our favorite photos is of Brands, Wines, and Liquors in Harlem on 145th Street, and it has a gorgeous marquee sign, like a movie theater. And it also had some other signage as well as the marquee, all neon, and it was absolutely gorgeous, especially at night. And the owner, when we photographed it and we went in to interview him, he's like, oh, that's the reason I got this business. I fell in love with the signage, and they're trying to force me to take it down. I'm like, they who? And, you know, who is that? And he's like, the city. They're fining me every day retroactively from the day that I bought the store that I have to get rid of this sign, and I don't want to get rid of it. I love it.
Well, what is the fear that the sign's going to fall down and hurt somebody?
I guess.
Because it's also neon signs that they are prohibiting.
Right.
Don't
they don't allow
why.
Them anymore. I mean, only in certain neighborhoods. Like, I guess it's like Times Square that's allowed to have, you know, the illuminated signs, but it's very, very hard to get an illuminated sign permit now, apparently.
Yeah, and Brands Liquors, that was interesting because he actually racked up over $50,000 worth of fines fighting the city to keep his sign, and eventually he lost the battle.
Yeah, and he had to take it down, and if you go there now, it's still in business, but it's just a plastic, you know, kind of ugly sign.
Yeah, some of there have been all sorts of other rules changes. People used to smoke fish in the back of their stores. They don't. Can they still do that?
The smoked aspect, that's a grandfathered clause as well. So if you're grandfathered in, if it was in existence before a certain year, but yes, it's the same rules. The same with the coffee, where they do the coffees, like Puerto Rico.
Roasting.
Right. They do the roasting in their plant in Brooklyn, but they used to do things like, you know, right in the village.
But D'Amico still does that in Brooklyn.
Exactly.
They have a roaster in their store. I think that's part of the appeal. You walk in and you smell roasting coffee, and it's almost impossible not to buy it. A lot of places also made their own cheese, mozzarella especially. Didn't one of the shop owners tell you that New York has very special water, and that's a reason that we have better cheese?
Yes, Joe's Dairy, which is still in existence on Sullivan Street. In fact, we were walking here today, and we purposely walked right by it because we like to check up on our stores, so to speak. And they make all their cheese every day, as well as a bunch of the cheese places, you know, DiPaolo's every day. And
although DiPaolo used to make it outside when they had a small store. They used to make it out on the street, and they don't do that anymore. They have a special room.
Right.
Right. They have the curd delivered every morning and make the cheese.
Now, you didn't only shoot stores. You shot the Wonder Wheel.
Yes, because it was part of, like, Gregory and Paul's is in the photo. So it was like a dual purpose that the Wonder Wheel and the roller coaster are in the photo, but it was and Gregory and Paul's for the business on the Coney Island.
Yeah, there's a real neat story about the Wonder Wheel.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You can tell it, Jim. It's okay.
No,
I know she did most of the interviews.
The owner bought it as a gift for his wife to make it the biggest ring that he could to show the world how much he loved her. So he said it was the biggest engagement ring he could buy.
And yeah, it broke my heart. Like when he told us that, and I was like, oh my God, that's so sweet.
Well, that's still a success.
Yes.
There were also some shops you discovered that were the first to bring their products to the United States. The first cappuccino machine?
Yes, that's Cafe Reggio, yes, in McDougal Street.
And that's still in business, isn't it?
Yes, it's still in business. They've painted, and they look slightly different than it is in the picture. Like now they have like kind of a brighter green facade. I personally like the darker green that's in the photo, but it's personal preference.
My guests are James and Carla Murray. Their book, Storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York, is published by Ginkgo Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk a little bit about M. Shames and Son Paint. How long have they been in the paint business?
I think that was third generation now, right? Am I correct in thinking that? And though they had a funny, funny story when we were photographing it. He was telling us, you know, first of all, he's like, oh, there's not that many businesses of Jewish descent in the neighborhood anymore because a lot of the Jewish people have moved out of this area of the Lower East Side. And then he was telling us about how there was a holdup in the store and, you know, somebody was trying to rob someone else. And
they were trying to rob two Hasidic Jews.
Exactly. And it turns out the Hasidic Jews were undercover cops and... And then ended up arresting the guy. And he's like, oh, it was the funniest thing, because usually in the Hasidic religion, they're very, you know, reserved and laid back and not into confrontations.
They'll stay out of any conflict.
Right, right. And, you know.
But then the Hasidic man pulled a gun.
Exactly.
Yeah, something was up.
And threw the guy on the ground. And
you devote a good portion of the book to pictures of businesses in the Lower East Side and Harlem, but not too many to Chinatown or the Upper West Side. Is that just because you don't go to those neighborhoods very much?
No, we just ran out of room in the book. I mean, it took us probably close to 2 years of just editing. I mean, we have so many photos. I mean, we had to rent a storage unit for all the photographs that we have. And the owner of Ginkgo Press was very instrumental in helping us edit, because we felt a very personal attachment to some of the stores, being that we had photographed it and interviewed them. We're like, no, we can't not put that in. And he's just like, oh, it's too much. You know, the book is like an albatross. It's like, you know, over 1,000 pages. So we had to whittle it down. But hopefully we'll be covering those. And definitely Chinatown, we have way more photos that will be in the follow-up book.
And the outer boroughs, I assume.
Definitely. Yes. Especially Brooklyn, we didn't have that many neighborhoods. And there's so many neighborhoods in Brooklyn that, you know, definitely have the ethnic background as well.
And Queens is covered more.
Right, Queens and the Bronx as well. Right.
Some people you talked to didn't seem to mind the gentrification. In fact, many of the proprietors on the Lower East Side businesses appear to be relieved. In some ways, they feel things have improved since the 80s. So on the one hand, we're sorry to see these changes. On the other hand, people who are doing business there may not be so sorry to see the changes.
Right. I remember, actually, that was the owner of Russ and Daughters said, oh, you know, I used to come here and you'd be, like, you know, nervous at night locking up and leaving because it really wasn't a good neighborhood. And
don't forget that the owner of the Second Avenue Deli was robbed and killed.
Mm. Exactly.
When he was going to the bank with the day's take.
Right. I mean, we remember because we're residents of the Lower East Side, you know, East Village for a long time ourselves. And, I mean, our car used to get broken into for nothing. I mean, there was nothing. It was a terrible old car, and there was nothing in it to steal. And they would just, if you dropped a penny on, and, you know, it would land in on the seat as you were getting out, they'd break in for your penny.
You discovered quite a few interesting and bizarre laws and regulations while researching the book. Like Russ and Daughters, there's been no fish smoked in Manhattan since the turn of the 20th century?
Right. You know, a lot of the businesses, I guess, predated refrigeration. So the whole aspect of smoking things was, you know, a way of preserving. So you could sell these products. And, you know, that started with peddling on the street, you know, the push carts. So, yeah, it was really fascinating to find out that info.
And Jimmy's Candy and Stationery in Brooklyn explained to us that he used to do all his business in the morning. The kids would come in with their parents and buy candy for the school day. And the parents would get their coffee, newspapers. It was a bustling time. And he's like, now the schools frisk the children and take all the candy away. They don't let them bring candy into the school with them. So now he's like, it's a ghost town in the morning. So it's another thing you would never even realize would affect their business.
Well, until recently, you couldn't barbecue in Manhattan because people weren't capable of building chimneys high enough. Now we're seeing a whole bunch of barbecue places, so people have gone around some of those regulations, but barbecue is not one of the old traditions. I'm sure you didn't find a 1920s barbecue restaurant.
Just one, probably the oldest one would probably be Sherman's Barbecue in Harlem.
A listener suggests that the two of you start a community online project for people to post pictures of their neighborhood favorites. Have you thought of doing that?
Well, we have a Flickr account. We belong to a bunch of Flickr pools. It's just like an online, you know, photo sharing site. And a lot of people, we've posted, and then people post their own too. So there are a lot of mom and pop storefront groups that people can contribute to.
A number of listeners have written into our show page asking you about your influences, and some suggest Richard Estes and Zoe Leonard's Analog, this documentary project on the Lower East Side. Richard Essie's a painter, isn't he?
I'm not so familiar with that work, but I mean, as far as personal people that have influenced us, I would definitely say Berenice Abbott, And on the tip that, you know, we're husband and wife photographer, we'd have to say an influence was Bernard and Hilla Bescher.
And, of course, Aceh.
Right, and Aceh.
People who went out in the street and photographed the environment that they were living in looked like.
Exactly.
Aceh did a lot of pictures out of his own window, didn't he?
Right, and he would go out in the early morning in Paris and photograph places when they were still very desolate. And, you know, in our book, there are some people in the photographs, but it was a conscious decision that we made early on to not have that many people in the photographs.
Many people have written in about what happened at the Essex Market, which used to be such a bustling area and now has just been diminished into very little, partly, again, because of rents and changing demographics.
Right. I mean, we've gone there a lot ourselves because we don't live that far away, and that's one of our, you know, favorite locales. I mean, of course, for us, it's not truly a storefront. That's more like, you know, kind of just a gathering thing that I guess was set up when they're trying to get all the push carts out of the city. That's when they set up those markets.
Don't you have an exhibit now at the Click Gallery?
Yes, we do. It's Click Gallery. It's at 255 Center Street at the corner of Broome, and we have many of our storefront photos on display and blown up to some of them to fairly large size, so it'll be nice for people to see them that way.
And you can find out more information about that by going to our show page at WNYC.org. The exhibit is until March 27th, so you have a couple of weeks. And my great thanks to James and Carla Murray for being with us to talk about Storefront, the disappearing face of New York, their book published by Ginkgo. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.